BCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the Internet at bcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And we thank you for joining us here on Crosstalk on BCY America. Recently, I was reading through the book of Jeremiah, and I came across Jeremiah 32, verse 17, which says, "Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee." Indeed, the heaven and the earth made by God's great power. All you have to do is look at the sky and sit back and wonder in awe. I mean, I've been just looking into the skies on a dark night, just amazed by what I see. But there's another pair of verses in Psalm verse 8, or chapter 8, verses 3 and 4. "When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him?" What an amazing thought that the God who made the universe also cares about you. Well, today we're going to focus in on the heavens, and to help us with that, we welcome to Crosstalk Dr. Danny Faulkner. He's got a Master's of Science in Physics, a Master's of Arts, and PhD in Astronomy. Taught at the University of South Carolina, Lancaster for over 26 years. Serves as editor of the Creation Research Quarterly, has published over 100 papers in various journals. He's a researcher and author, speaker for Answers in Genesis, and the author of numerous books, including the newly released The Heavens, A Different View. Dr. Faulkner, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back with you.
You actually had a fascination in astronomy as a child. Tell us about it.
Oh, people ask me how or when I got involved into astronomy, and I really can't remember a time that I was not fascinated with it.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in southwest Missouri until I was between ages 2 and 5, and I remember sitting on the front stoop of the house and looking up at the sky at night and being just really amazed by the stars up there in the sky. And that's my earliest recollection of loving astronomy. But, you know, growing up, I would check out books from our school library on astronomy, and pretty soon I tell people I'd read both of them, and it was just more of a learning experience. But it wasn't until I was a sophomore in high school that I realized that this was my calling in life, that this is what the Lord wanted me to do. So I feel like I'm doing exactly what God made me to do.
And you've been looking at the sky now for many decades. What fascinates you the most?
Oh, it's hard to narrow down. The beauty of the things we can see, the wonder, I think the sizes, the scale of the universe is one of those things that the human mind really, really can't get their heads wrapped around. We use, you know, big numbers, millions and billions and quadrillions and so forth, and we define whole units like light years and such to try to encapsulate those monstrously big numbers. But I don't think anybody can really comprehend that. And what I like to reflect upon is that we have a big, powerful universe, but it requires a creator far larger and far more powerful yet to have created that. But yet, Psalm 8, David writes there asking the question, age-old question of meaning of life, you know, who am I, who are we, that you take notice of us?
Yeah.
And it's very important because God does have very much concern with us individually.
You have also advanced in not only your love, but abilities in photography of the heavens. How long have you been doing that?
Well, about 6 years. I kind of started late on it. I think when I was very young, I would have liked to have done it, but I didn't have the equipment, and I didn't have the budget. And as I got later on, I had the budget, and maybe I could get access to the equipment, but it didn't really occur to me. And I'm so glad I waited, because back years ago, it would have been film, which is expensive to buy and process, and now with digital cameras, you're simply wasting your time if you don't get something good. It's no expense really involved. So I started off about 6 years ago wanting to take some photographs of the sky in an attempt to find some images to illustrate some of my writing, some of my books and my online articles and such, because I think it's kind of good to kind of have your own pictures. You don't have to worry about other people's pictures and maybe getting permission for them. There are a lot of astronomy photos you can get that are in the public domain because the taxpayers paid for it. But I'd still like to get our own and have control over those things. So that was my initial interest in doing that.
And you certainly do have some spectacular photos in this book called The Heavens. You call, in this book, you call astronomy a special science. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's kind of artsy. It was classified as one of the seven liberal arts from, you know, classical antiquity and through the Middle Ages. The only science we'd recognize among them, and it's not an experimental science for the most part. It's more observational. I think, again, the beauty and wonder aspect kind of touches on that, and I think it grabs at the hearts and minds of people more than any other science. I think if you don't look at some of the things we have in astronomy and come away with wonder, there's something wrong with it.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
It just speaks to the soul more than any other science, I believe.
So let's look at some of the specifics in your book. For instance, we're all familiar with the sun rising in the east, setting in the west, but you indicate that the moon and the stars also do the same. That's news to many.
Yeah, you know, when I do planetarium shows or describe what's going on in the sky with people, most people are familiar with sunrise and sunset. I think everybody is, but they don't think about it, and they should, because when the sun sets at night, that the rotation of the earth that causes that doesn't stop. If it did, then the sun wouldn't rise tomorrow, would it? So throughout the night, the stars, the planets, the moon, they, for the most part, they rise, they set. They're really going in two big circles, in the sky with two centers. One center you can see for us in the northern hemisphere, it's in the north, and if you're in the southern hemisphere, it's in the south. And it's like there's a big, we're inside of a big globe or something, and the whole sky is spinning around us. That's the impression you get by looking at it. And, of course, it could be, but it also could be we're spinning inside and on our axis, which I think is the more appropriate one. But we have some photographs in the book that show that kind of rotation. Got to emphasize, I didn't take all these photos myself. Many of them were taken by two amateur astronomers, Glenn Fountain and Jim Bonser. They're amateurs. They're better astrophotographers than I am, actually, and they were very happy to lend their efforts in the book. In fact, I got an email from one of them the other day, and he was just really touched. He said his motivation was sort of like mine. He wanted to share the wonder of God's creation with people, and he thought this book would certainly do that better than he ever could, reaching far more people. But he has one there that Jim Bonser took of the stars circling around the bow of the Ark.
Yes.
The Ark encounter. And that's a really cool photo. That's a half-hour exposure that he did several years ago.
It is beautiful. And you do, by the way, have several photos yourself in here, too. Is it true, though, that some stars do not rise or set?
Yeah, they're in the northern part of the sky for us. Anything within about, for me, within almost 40 degrees of what we call the North Celestial Pole, the stars will spin in circles around in the sky. And it's good to take long exposure photographs to show those concentric circles. I can't show this in a book, but I've been doing some time lapse. We'll take photographs over many hours, and I'll put them together in a little video. It's only 20, 30 seconds long that shows the spinning and motion going around. Great set up, of course. But that's a fun thing to illustrate what's going on. You could sit out at night and watch it, but it's kind of slow. But the photographs can really bring that in for you. We call those stars circumpolar, by the way.
Okay. And now many believe Polaris, or the North Star, is the brightest and the most the very first visible star, but you indicate that's not the case.
Yeah, it's Polaris is down the list a ways. There are probably 50 or more stars brighter than Polaris. I don't know how that idea got started, but there is something kind of special about it. I mentioned those two spots in the sky that the stars spin around. They're called the celestial poles. Polaris is very close to one of those, about three-quarters of a degree away from it. So to the naked eye, and even through a long exposure photograph with a wide-angle lens, it's going to look like a dot. It's not going to noticeably move. But if you put a telescope on it, it does actually spin. I've done a time-lapse video showing that. But it's close enough that it stays in the same part of the sky to within three-quarters of a degree. And that will allow you to find your north direction. You can even find your latitude by noticing how high above the sky that appears, high above the horizon appears.
Is there also a bright star close to the south celestial pole?
No, there is no south star. There is a star called Sigma Octantis that some people call a pole star. But, you know, on a really dark night, you might see it, but most times you can't see it. It's too faint. So there are a lot of neat things in the southern hemisphere that we don't have. We can't see, but one thing they don't have is we have the North Star.
We're talking with Dr. Danny Faulkner today from Answers in Genesis and the author of a book, numerous books, but this one here today, The Heavens, A Different View, that's filled with wonderful photography in it. Let's talk about galaxies for a bit. We're in the Milky Way galaxy. How many stars are in this galaxy, Milky Way?
We can only estimate, but the estimate is a few hundred billion stars.
A few hundred billion.
Yeah, the way we get that is we can make some measurements of motions of stars in the galaxy, and from that we can figure out how much mass is required to hold it all together to cause that orbital motion. That's a pretty common thing we do in physics and astronomy. And it turns out to be a couple hundred billion times the mass of the sun. And if you figure, well, on average each star has one mass of the sun, then that's where the couple hundred billion stars come in.
And the Milky Way is but one galaxy. Any idea how many galaxies there are?
A few hundred billion. So I'll leave it up to the listeners to figure out how many stars that is.
Yeah, I can't wrap my brain around that one. And yet, when we go to Genesis chapter 1, it's almost like an add-on. Oh, and he made the stars also.
Yeah, I've often said to people, I think it's almost like the Lord put that in there just for me. Say, oh, by the way, Dan, in case you're wondering, because I really like stars. That's my specialty in astronomy. And it's almost like an add-on. It focuses on the lights, the greater and lesser light, the sun and the moon, but then he says, and he made the stars too. And that encapsulates everything out beyond those other two bright objects.
And you refer to the few hundred billion stars in the Milky Way, a few hundred billion galaxies out there, but God knows the exact number and knows them.
Yeah, he counts them. He names them. We have catalog designations for a few million stars probably today. But they're usually just numbers in a catalog. We have a couple hundred stars that have proper names. But, you know, the Lord, when he names things, he has meaning behind them and has purpose. And he doesn't share those names with us, I don't think. But maybe that's what eternity is for, to tell us some of the star names and a few other things.
Wow. So what can you tell us about the closest galaxy to us, Andromeda?
Okay, it's the closest galaxy of any size. And one thing we haven't mentioned is that I mentioned when I said a few hundred billion galaxies, those are the big galaxies like our own Milky Way. They're typically 100,000 light years or so across. There are many, many, many small galaxies. We'll come back to those later if you want to, but Andromeda Galaxy is the largest galaxy, similar in size to our own, and it's, we think, a little over 2 million light years away. On a dark autumn evening, you can make it out with the naked eye. I've seen it many, many times. If you're inside of a city, probably not. It looks like a little fuzzy spot, like a little out-of-focus star. Through binoculars or telescope, you can see it more light, more of a smudge. When you look at it, you're only looking at the central part of it, the nucleus of the galaxy. It actually extends several degrees across the sky. And it's been the object of study for a very, very long time. Edwin Hubble did a lot of work on it a century ago, and it's become a very important stepping stone in understanding the structure of the universe and knowing about galaxies in general.
Yeah, there's some very fascinating pictures in your book on many of galaxies. One of those is M81, some 12 million light years away. How is it possible to obtain such dynamic photos?
Oh, well, that's modern photography. By the way, the galaxy photos were not taken by me. They're taken by those amateurs. And they're really good at what they do. Hopefully one day I can be as good. Mm. It takes the right kind of equipment, and in the case of you need very good let me turn that phone off for a second here.
I'll tell you what. We're...
You need very good a very good mount that is very, very balanced and also very closely aligned. That's a very, very key thing.
We're up against a break here, so we'll quick take the break. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Crosstalk on the VCY America Network.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, president of the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, was the extinction of dinosaurs caused by an asteroid hitting the Earth?
Chris, this is a favorite evolutionary claim that some 65 million years ago an asteroid smashed into the Earth and sent the dinosaurs into extinction. But did you know that a lot of evolutionists deny this? Some are now saying that the dinosaurs were already going into extinction before the asteroid hit. You see, it's really difficult to reconstruct unobserved history. But the Bible gives us the key. The Bible tells us that God created all the animals, including the dinosaurs, during creation week. Most of them were wiped out in the great flood of Noah's day, and the fossils are primarily those animals that died in the flood. Two of each kind survived on board Noah's ark, but many of them, of course, have gone extinct since then. You see, Chris, everything fits into the Back to Genesis view of history.
Thanks for joining us for Back to Genesis.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. We're talking today with Dr. Danny Faulkner, just recently released this book called The Heavens, A Different View. I mean, folks, this is a beautiful hardcover, 108-page book, brilliant photography of the heavens. You'll see star trails, the Milky Way from the Grand Canyon even. That's one Dr. Faulkner took. You'll find multiple galaxies. There's Orion, star clusters, North America Nebula, several photos of the sun and the moon. There's Jupiter, Saturn, comets, and so much more, plus scripture to indeed verify that the heavens do declare. A newly released book, its cover price retails for $19.99. However, it's one of the books of the month at our VCY bookstore. And through January 31st, through the end of this month, our VCY bookstore is offering this at 40% off. That makes it just $11.99 plus any applicable tax and shipping. They're featuring it as one of their go-to books here for the month. It's available right now at VCY.com, VCY.com, or by calling 1-888-722-4829. That's 1-888-722-4829. When I got my copy, folks, I couldn't put it down. I had to go from page after page. It's something you can leave out on the coffee table or leave in a waiting room, and you'll find others picking it up and just be fascinated by the photography that is in here. And we were talking about the photography, Dr. Faulkner, as to how to obtain these galaxies so many million light years away and obtaining these, and that's right where we were when we entered into that break.
Well, you know, I've been stunned by what amateur astronomers can do today. It's testimony to the new electronic cameras that exist. Amateur astronomers now are taking photographs that only professional astronomers could take a few years ago, and maybe even better in many respects. I just can't get over that. And you need some good equipment, but the prices of equipment are coming way down. One thing you need is a reasonably dark sky. I've seen some of these pictures that we have not taken through the very best skies, but they're dark enough. And a lot of tricks, a lot of technique that you do. Instead of taking like a 2-hour exposure, what you do is you take a bunch of 10 or 15 second exposures and then stack them in Photoshop. It works out better to do it that way than just one long exposure. I've not really graduated to that. I may at some point, but the amateurs who have, two amateur astronomers who have contributed mightily to this, that's what they were doing. They were taking a lot of exposures over many, many nights and then putting them together. And that's the sort of thing that professional astronomers did for years, but now amateurs can easily do it with the electronic cameras.
Now, I referred to this as being the Galaxy M81. What does the M mean?
The M stands for Messier. That was a French astronomer, Charles Messier, who lived about the time of the American Revolution, French Revolution too. He was a comet hunter, and he would scan the skies looking for little smudges in the sky, little bright smudges. Those are what comets sometimes look like. But he would stumble across galaxies and star clusters and nebulae, which are clouds of gas and dust. They're glowing. And he would think it's a comet, and then he'd realize it wasn't. So he got so tired of stumbling across these again and again, he put together a catalog of a little over 100 entries. So when he saw one, he could check his catalog real quick and make sure he wasn't rediscovering something he had already seen. And the irony is after more than two centuries, he's remembered for the things he really didn't like. They were just kind of an impediment getting in his way.
Wow. But the catalog keeps getting bigger and bigger. You've got photos of something called a whirlpool galaxy. What is that?
Okay, that would be M51. That's Messier's 51st entry, and it's called a whirlpool because of the kind of a whirlpool shape. It's a spiral galaxy, and we're seeing it face on. Most galaxies you see at a different angle, but this one is almost completely face on. We think our own galaxy looks a bit like this. There's a nucleus in the middle and spiral arms coming off of it. And I forget who exactly it was now who called it the whirlpool, but it would have been like in the 1840s, 1850s that they saw this through the telescope large enough for their eyes to actually see that spiral pattern and gave it that name.
We were just talking about distance a bit ago, and the question is prompted, what is the furthest object that we've ever been able to obtain a photograph of?
Oh, boy, on the order of 10 billion light years or so. When you get out that far, even getting the distance is a bit tricky. The James Webb Space Telescope just launched a few weeks ago, and it's still deploying, still being put into its paces. And it was designed with large aperture and also for the part of the spectrum it's most sensitive in to look for the most distant galaxies possible because of a thing called the redshift that we get a great distance, the Hubble relation. Very distant galaxies have their light shifted out of the visible and into the infrared part of the spectrum. So this new telescope is optimized to pick up infrared, being able to pick these things up where they are their brightest. And they're hoping to push this to maybe 12 or 13 billion light years.
And I'm sure you're anxiously awaiting those photographs.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Faulkner, you were just talking about these billions of light years away. And in your book, you talk about 12 million light years away. You also write about another 30 to 50 million light years away, 500 million light years away. How could the light from these distant objects reach us if creation is only measured in thousands of years?
I've got to realize that a light year is a unit of distance, not a unit of time. If light change moves at the constant rate of about 186,282 miles per second, then in the course of the year it will move about 6 trillion miles. Those are big numbers again. And we can measure those by various means, and I think the distances are probably close to being correct, within 10 or 20% in many cases. So the universe is vast. I used to fret about how the world, if the universe is only thousands of years old, as Scripture seems to indicate, how can we see the light? And I've come upon a solution that deals with what God may have done on day four. It describes in the day four account that he created the stars then, but he also made the plants on day three. And if you look carefully the way he made those, he brought them out of the ground, it says. They grew up very quickly out of the ground. So why? Well, because they had to mature those plants to provide food for man and beast that would come along a few days later. In similar manner, the stars couldn't fulfill their functions if they could not be seen by the end of the creation week, at least, and probably by the end of day four. So God made a fully functioning universe. I think he performed a miracle on day four to bring the light here very quickly, despite what the suggestion might be otherwise, involving the distance. But you know what? If you really get your head wrapped around creation, that God made everything, and how immense and powerful the universe is, getting the light here from the most distant parts of the universe is really small potatoes compared to the problem of creating the universe in the first place. I think the real problem is creation.
Yeah. Every day a miracle. Every day. Constellations. The Bible mentions two of them. What are they?
It mentions Orion, which is one of my two favorites. It mentions Pleiades, which is not exactly a constellation. It's a star cluster, a very beautiful star cluster. Both visible this time of year in our winter sky in the northern hemisphere. There's also a possibility that another constellation, the Crooked Serpent, is also mentioned. It's kind of vague. And also the Big and Little Bear may be mentioned. It says, I believe in Job, it says, talking about the bears. Arcturus is mentioned, and that's the name of a star, but it really could refer to the Big Bear. So there are two clearly identified things, and then two or three others possibly mentioned as well.
Let's move on. There's much more I could talk about the stars here, but let's talk about the sun for a bit, because you also have several photos in your book on the sun, the largest body in our solar system. Help us understand the magnitude of the sun.
Okay, well, the sun's about 93 million miles away from us. It's nearly a million miles across. The diameter of the sun is 109 times the Earth's diameter. If you turn to that page in there with the sun, you'll see a picture that I took a few years ago. It's on page 53. And I had somebody Photoshop the Earth in there for comparison.
Wow.
And you can see how tiny it is. I enjoy showing sunspots to people when they're out on the sun.
Are sunspots, are they blemishes?
Well, no. There's cooler regions in the sun. Strong magnetic fields are located there. They look dark. They really aren't. They're just not quite as bright as the rest of the sun. But I have people look at it and say, oh, those tiny little things. And I say, well, that tiny little thing you're looking at is actually two or three times the size of the Earth.
Wow.
The sun is really big. Its mass is about a third of a million more than the Earth is. If you want to do volume, that really kind of cheats. If you made a big sphere the size of the sun, you could fit over a million Earths inside.
That's amazing. Yeah, you see that little Earth that's up against the sun there, the Photoshop. It is amazing. What powers the sun?
What power? What do you mean? What power is it? The our best understanding is that it's a nuclear power. It's a conversion, a fusion of hydrogen to helium. About 4 million tons of mass disappears every second, and there's actually evidence to support that. The sun gives off little interesting particles called neutrinos. We've been detecting those for several decades. And it was a problem a number of years ago, back in the 60s through the 90s, that we thought there weren't enough of them. We now resolve that issue. And the sun is, we've measured several parts of the neutrinos given off, and they pretty well match what our expectation is. We have direct evidence now that the sun's energy is coming from nuclear power.
Wow. Does the sun itself provide any clues as to its own age or age of the galaxy or age of the Earth?
Well, that's tricky. Somebody asked that question a number of years ago, and I had to think about it long and hard. The sun itself is difficult to date. We can calculate what its how long its maximum lifetime could be, and it's on the order of 10 billion years. And people say, well, that must be billions of years. And I say, well, no, it could be far, far younger than that.
Mm-hmm.
It could actually be only thousands of years old. It just can't be any older than that amount.
Mm-hmm.
And our understanding of the sun is that it would have been much brighter in the past if it's billions of years old. And if that's the case, then it presents a much fainter in the past. It's getting brighter with time. And if that's the case, then the early Earth, if billions of years ago, would have been very cold.
Mm.
They're thinking like 3.5 billion years ago that the temperature of the Earth would have been about something like 17 Celsius cooler than it is today. The average temperature on the Earth today is 15 Celsius. You do the math, it would have been -2, which in real temperature is like 28 degrees Fahrenheit. That would have been the average, which nobody believes the Earth is ever like that.
Right.
So I think this early faint sun paradox is kind of an indication that the sun is not nearly as old as most people think.
So we have a section in your book also on the moon. Was the moon created with craters, or did something cause those craters?
I think they were caused by something. It looks to me like there were impacts that took place on the moon. I think it's inconsistent with God's character to make an object look as if it had been peppered when it really wasn't. And I developed a theory about that. I think the moon, a lot of the craters on the moon probably were a date from the time when God put it together on day 4. I don't think he made the moon instantly. I think he had a little bit of assembly process, just like he had to assemble Adam, for instance, had to assemble Eve, and had to assemble the animals out of the dust of the ground like man. So it was an assembly process, and I think there was also a second episode that may have happened at the time of the flood.
There is also, through recent years in particular, Dr. Faulkner, as you know, a lot of emphasis on blood moons. If you could define what is a blood moon and what, if any, significance is there to it?
Well, that's a sore spot for me. It was somebody about a dozen years, about 10 or 12 years ago, started promoting this idea that when the moon usually turns some shade of red during a lunar eclipse, then that's what they call a blood moon. Well, that nomenclature only goes back about 10 or 12 years, believe it or not.
Hmm.
Prior to that, the blood moon was generally understood to be the moon after the harvest moon, sometime in October, sometimes called the hunter's moon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of been appropriated by people and fighting a losing battle here. But we do have a section on eclipses in the book, and we talk about nice photos of the moon in eclipse.
Well, let's take a quick break. Folks, we'll be opening phone lines in a short time, but I've got a few more questions I'd like to ask of our guest today, Dr. Danny Faulkner, who has just released a book entitled, it's called The Heavens, A Different View. Again, after the break, we'll tell you how you can obtain a copy of this book and join in the fascination, even as I have as well. Back in a minute, you're listening to Crosstalk. James 4:14 poses this thought. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Have you ever stopped to consider where you will spend eternity? You may say, but I'm a good person. I care for my family. I feed the poor. I stand up for life and traditional values. While all of these things are good, they fall far short of God's standard. Every one of us has a sin issue that must be dealt with. Our sin separates us from God, and each of us deserves to be eternally removed from God in everlasting punishment. But out of God's great love, he sent his Son, Jesus Christ, to bear our sins, shed his blood, die on the cross, and rise again. He is the only way of salvation, and it's imperative for you to place your trust in him. If you're wrestling with this issue, we'd like to send you a complimentary leaflet, Where Will You Spend Eternity? To receive a copy, just ask for it when you call us at 1-800-729-9829. 800-729-9829. I mean, you look at the photos in this book and then the narrative that goes along with it, you just say, wow, it's amazing. I mean, to know that the heavens declare the glory of God, the earth showeth his handiwork as well, the firmament does. This book, The Heavens, A Different View, as we mentioned, it's a beautiful hardcover 108-page book. Dr. Danny Faulkner, along with a couple other amateur photographers, have taken the brilliant photography in this book of The Heavens. Again, you'll see things like the star trails, the Milky Way. I like that picture there from the Grand Canyon you took, various galaxies, star clusters, photos of the sun and the moon, Jupiter, Saturn, so much more. But scripture in the book as well, and just released, 1999, it's a hardcover book, but it's being featured at the VCY Bookstore as a book of the month, 40% off, just $11.99 plus any applicable tax and shipping. It's available at vcy.com, vcy.com, or by calling 1-888-722-4829. We're talking about eclipses. You mentioned the lunar eclipse. There's also been the big, spectacular solar eclipse. I love the photo in your book, by the way, of where you're standing back and saying, wow. You can see the amazement on your own face, Dr. Faulkner, as you're seeing the eclipse of the sun.
I love that photo. You know, the fellow that took that was standing right in front of me, and I didn't know he was there. It was toward the end of the eclipse, and I could not repeat that expression on my face if my life depended on it.
Yeah, just in awe of the eclipse. Anything special you want to say about eclipses?
Oh, I've seen two total solar eclipses. They shut my mouth. During eclipses, I shut up and don't say anything.
Yeah.
I'm so absorbed by it. And it's the most remarkable thing I have ever experienced in my life. And people say, well, if you think we've seen one, you've seen one. Well, yeah, you have. But they're all very different. The mm-hmm. two total solar eclipses I've experienced were so different from one another, you can't compare them. I'm looking forward to 2024, just 2 years away in April. There's another one. Comes close to where we live here.
Wow. But you've also got a section in your book on other objects in the solar system. Dr. Faulkner, what planet in our solar system fascinates you the most?
Oh, looking at things, I prefer Saturn. I tell people that's my favorite thing to look at through the telescope. I first looked at Saturn. It was in September of 1969. It's been over a half century now, and I've never gotten over it. But when it comes to just looking at the features of a planet, I can't do this myself. I have to look at photos and stuff. I think Mars is an incredible planet. But just looking at something, Saturn is, anyone's ever seen Saturn through a telescope will agree with me. It mm-hmm. doesn't look real. It looks fake through the telescope.
Wow. Well, you mentioned earlier about the James Webb Telescope, and it was just launched this past Christmas Day. This telescope launched into space, and it's said to seek the light from the first galaxies in the early universe. Also, Dr. Faulkner, we've been told that this may also find life out there somewhere. Your comments on this, and some are saying, hey, this is going to help us find the origin of life, so we can find a whole lot a cheaper way to do that, just go to the Book of Genesis. But your comments about this telescope, I know you're waiting for the photos there, but are some of the premises for which we're sending this out there rather flawed?
Well, I think the problem there is when you talk about the earliest galaxies, when they look at the great distances, like 10 billion light years, they're thinking in terms of look-back time.
Mm-hmm.
If the universe is indeed that old and the light's been traveling that long, then yes, I guess it would be a look-back time. And so they think the universe began 13.8 billion years ago in what we call the Big Bang. So if you look back at a galaxy 13 billion light years away, you're looking at something that's formed just less than a billion years after the universe began. That's what they're talking about in terms of looking at the first galaxies to form in the universe. That's not always been the way astronomers have looked at it. Until a half century ago, many people thought the universe is eternal, and this kind of terminology would have made no sense. And of course, we biblical creationists think have a very different story to tell about the history and the age of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And as for the planets, they've been looking for what we call exoplanets for 25 plus years now, actually discovered them 25 years ago. We're now up to about 4,500 of them. And the reason why they keep looking for these is because they're trying to find Earth-like planets where life might exist. And that's because they believe that a naturalistic origin of life, that there is no creator, that life naturally arose. And if the Earth is the only place in the universe where life exists, then that makes the Earth by definition unique. It also makes it very special, and that kind of drags you right back to creation. So most evolutionists understand that in order to support their worldview, they have to find life elsewhere, and to do that, you have to find Earth-like planets. And I mentioned that 4,500 figure. I'm of the opinion that, of scientific opinion here, that none of the 4,500 planets they've discovered so far outside the Earth are Earth-like at all. And that's stunning, because I think, you know, 30 years ago, if you would ask most astronomers, well, when they found 4,500 planets, exoplanets, how many of them would be Earth-like, I think you could have probably heard estimates of in the hundreds. We've not found one yet.
Hmm.
And again, the evidence is showing that the Earth is very special, which agrees with our worldview here. So I welcome the James Webb Telescope to look for some of these things and try to hone in, but I can make a prediction now. I don't think they're going to find Earth-like planets.
Dr. Denny Faulkner is our guest here today on Crosstalk. He does have both his master's and Ph.D. in astronomy. We're going to open our phone lines here. If you have a question about the heavens, stars, moon, the planetary, sun, pick up your phone, give us a call. Constellations 800-733-9829. That's 1-800-733-9829. Dr. Faulkner, I'm going to put you on the spot for a moment. If aside from heaven itself, if you could visit one object in outer space, what would it be?
One object. Oh, man. That is putting me on the spot. I think I might like to get a good look at a black hole from a safe distance.
Great, right?
That would be one of the coolest things to see.
Yeah. So just a comment about a black hole. What causes it? What is it?
Oh, a black hole is a star, if you will, an object that is so massive, so small, and so dense that the gravity itself can keep light from escaping from it. When you have a self-gravitating object like the Earth, there's what we call escape velocity, how fast something must go to escape from the object. For the Earth, it's only about 7 miles per second. For a black hole, it's going to be 186,000 miles per second, so we're far away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were first kind of predicted or anticipated 240 years ago, but they weren't detected until the 1960s. And now we know of hundreds, maybe thousands of them. Some of them are what we call stellar-sized black holes. They have anywhere from, say, 0.5 to maybe 10 or 20, 30 times the mass of the sun. Then there are supermassive black holes lurking at the centers of galaxies. For instance, there's very good evidence at the center of the Milky Way there is a giant black hole that has 2 to 3 million times the mass of the sun.
My. So you're not particular about which black hole. You just like to see one at a safe distance.
From a safe distance.
There we go. Okay, let's phone lines are packed. Let's go to Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I wanted to ask Dr. Faulkner. Several years ago, astronomers said the Bethlehem star returned. What was that? Was that the Regulus star that moved into the womb of the Virgin, or what was that?
Thank you, Elizabeth.
It's become very popular, very common in recent years to look at planetary alignments for being the Christmas star. About a dozen years ago, Rick Larson from Texas, I believe, put together a DVD called the Bethlehem Star. Passed around a lot around the Christmas season. I've looked into that. I'm not convinced. I'm kind of critical of that. I have an article on our website of that viewpoint. There have been other planetary alignments people suggested, and I think what you're referring to is the an alignment of Jupiter and Saturn that happened just a year ago. It was Christmas, right around Christmas of last year, 2020. And Jupiter and Saturn get close together in the sky once every two decades. Happened. I saw it in 1980, 2000, and then 2020. What made the one in 2020 different was the two stars got so close together, you could see them in the same field of view of a telescope, which I'd never seen before, never will see again. they didn't look like a single star. They looked like two bright stars close together in the sky. And that kind of got people excited at Christmas of a year ago. But I really don't think that's what the Christmas star was.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth. We're going next to Bowden in Maricopa, Arizona. You're on the air.
Hello. I got to see the transit of Venus across the sun in 2012, just bicycling in California, and I happened to be at the right place at the time. People who had telescopes and cameras let me watch.
Mm-hmm.
Without me curious about the sun and climate change, I looked up a few facts on the sun, and I was wondering if you read the book by Al Gore, Inconvenient Truth, and Bill Gates. I saw a load of books. And I'm wondering if they mentioned solar cycles of the sun, the explosions on the sun. I read it raised the temperature 10,000 degrees. I read that the center of the sun is a million degrees. And I'm wondering if these experts, Bill Gates and Al Gore, are they giving us information on the sun?
Okay. Thank you, Bowden.
I've not read that particular book. I read another book by Al Gore, I think, Earth and the Balance. That was before he wrote An Inconvenient Truth. But I have looked into the climate change, global warming concerns. And number one, climates do change. That's a fact of nature. We don't deny that at all. In fact, the flood of Noah was the mother of all climate change. But there have been natural cycles as well, and some of those seem to be correlated with sunspot cycles. There was a lot of sunspot activity 1,000 years ago, and it corresponded to a very warm time, at least in the northern hemisphere, and there's some other correlations as well. Now, correlation does not prove causation, and nobody knows what kind of mechanism might cause that. But so I think the jury should still be out on the question of can some natural cycles like the solar cycle affect that. The big question is, the second part of the question, I guess, would be, is man causing a significant change in climate? And then if so, should we or can we do anything about it? And those first question is definitely yes, climate changes. The second and third questions are not nearly as clear to me at all. But I think you're right. There is a connection between what the sun's doing and how it affects climate on Earth.
Great. Thank you, Bowden. Let's go next to Holman, Wisconsin. We have Scott calling. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah. I have done some studies on the Big Bang Theory, and from the best I can tell, Sir Fred Hoyle was making a joke one day that the universe just kind of burst forth out of nothing, and bang, there it was. And I think what happened was the Darwinian evolutionists just sort of grabbed onto that from desperation because they needed something, you know, to hang their theory, their quote theory on.
Mm-hmm.
But it started out as actually a joke that Sir Fred Hoyle made. Is that true? Am I right about that?
Well, not quite. You got some of the facts there right, but it's also got a wrong spin on it. The really quickly, I'll give a real thumbnail history here. Hubble discovered Hubble relation in 1929, and it suggests the universe is expanding, and people begin to ask the question, well, what does this mean? And they hit upon this idea that the universe is eternal. It's always been expanding. As it expands, it doesn't become less dense because new matter continuously creates to keep that standard, that average density all the time. Meanwhile, a guy named Lemaître came up with this idea that the universe was birthed in a super hot, dense state. He called it the cosmic egg. That was kind of a naive model. In 1948, two authors wrote a paper putting the first more detailed theory of this. And Fred Hoyle, a couple years later, criticized it and said the universe didn't begin in some sort of big bang. It was in a BBC radio broadcast. And that's where the name came from.
Thank you for the call. Interesting question. We're up against a break, so we'll take the break. We've got our final segment here. For more of your questions here on Crosstalk, Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. And if you missed how you can obtain a copy of the book, we'll give you that info here in the next segment as well. This is Crosstalk.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brennan House. Our website is worldviewreport.com. The most prestigious law enforcement magazine in America is called Law Enforcement Today. Their website, lawenforcementtoday.com. Let me repeat. It is the most widely read and prestigious law enforcement publication in America. This is not some extremist website.
It is read by the largest population of law enforcement officials in America. Today, their headline, is Washington State looking to detain residents in 2022 version of internment camps? Sure looks that way. It's about legislation in Washington State looking to try to throw Americans into internment camps over not being vaccinated, or maybe even supposedly being infected with COVID, much like Australia and Austria. Law enforcement magazines are paying attention. Are you?
It's a very fascinating topic, and folks, some fascinating photos in this brand new book that has come out entitled The Heavens, A Different View. And indeed, you'll see views you likely have not seen before, and all available in this hardcover book. Again, it's something you can have out on a coffee table or something to pick up at any time and just enjoy going through the photos and reading the narrative that goes along with it, the scripture that's in the book as well. But this 100-page hardcover book just released $19.99, but our bookstore featuring it this month at 40% off, just a total of $11.99 plus any applicable tax and shipping. It's available at vcy.com, vcy.com, or 1-888-722-4829. Dr. Faulkner, I forgot to clarify in the last section as well, when you mentioned, oh, we've got an article on our website, you're referring to answersingenesis.org, correct?
Yes, answersingenesis.org.
Okay, and folks, you'll find many, many questions, answers to questions that you may have there. We're going right back to the phone lines. Tucson, Arizona, we have Ed calling. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is the universe finite? I would think it would have to be, but as I see headlines of new galaxies being discovered and new stars being discovered, obviously I think these are just ones that are so far away that we just haven't been able to see their light yet because of the number of light years it takes to get through to us.
Okay.
Yeah, observationally, we can't determine the answer to that question, so most astronomers don't know. There's an edge to how far we can see. That's called the observable universe, but the belief is the universe could be far, far larger than that. In fact, almost astronomers think that the universe is actually bigger than what we can see of it. So the observable universe is less than the size of the entire universe. Could it be infinite? Could it be finite? Most astronomers don't know. I, however, think that there is a finite size to it. I think the universe has an edge. I get that from the creation account. It says on day two that God made this rakia expanse, which I think is space, and there's water at the edge of it. And you can't have water at the edge of the universe if the universe doesn't have an edge. If the universe has an edge, then it has a finite size. So I base my conclusion on how I understand the day two account of creation.
Thank you, Ed. Let's go to Leroy in Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air, Leroy.
Yes, I had two questions. The first one is, and as much as I want to ask you about the Luciferian object in the...
Let's go right to the question. We're short on time, Leroy.
Could you tell me why the moon and the sun said the sky at the same time, and what does it mean when you see a rainbow around the sun and the moon?
Okay, so how can the moon and the sun be in the sky at the same time? And any what was the causality of a rainbow around the moon or the sun, Dr. Faulkner?
Yeah, the common misconception that people have that the moon is only visible at night. It actually orbits around the Earth every month, and it spends half the time in the daytime sky and half the time in the nighttime sky. But however, when it's in the daytime sky, it's difficult to see. As I was coming back in from lunch earlier a couple hours ago, I saw the waning phase of the moon. I mean, first quarter moon, not waxing phase, first quarter moon up in the sky over in the eastern part of the sky. If it's clear today, you should be able to see that all afternoon and into the evening. When it's in the crescent phases, we don't see it so readily full. It's only up at night. So it's up half the time. You just don't notice it most of the time. As far as that rainbow hue, it's probably caused by cirrus clouds. We get what are called sun dogs. When the sun is low in the sky, on either side of the sun, you'll see a glow of light. And if the sun is high overhead with cirrus clouds, you can see a halo many times, and sometimes it has a rainbow hue to it. But it's caused by cirrus clouds.
Thank you, Leroy. Maxine in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering if your speaker was familiar with the Horsehead Nebula.
Yes, I've got a picture of the Horsehead Nebula right here on my desk. I'm looking at it right now. given to me by Glenn Fountain, one of the fellows that gave me photos for the book, and we have a picture of that in the book. I have only seen this nebula once. That was with a 24-inch telescope and a dark site, and it didn't look anything like the pictures because it is very faint. You need a lot of photography to get that, and I was impressed that Glenn was able to get such a marvelous photograph of that.
Yeah, it's a neat picture in your book, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Maxine. And Don in Pensacola, Florida, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Jim. I had a question for our guest. Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens singular and the earth. The modern New Age Bible say the heavens. I was wondering if you had a comment on that.
Yeah, the Hebrew word shemayim is the word for heaven or heavens, and it's what we call a dual form. There is no singular for it. The closest I can get to maybe give a comparison is like the word deer in English. It can have one deer, or you could have two or more deer. It's the same word. And if the word is in the subject of the sentence, the verb will tell you how to translate it as plural or singular. But if it's in the object of the sentence, as it is in Genesis 1:1, and in most places it occurs in the Bible, then it's up to the sense of the translator. And we really don't know how to translate it properly into English. It's not a problem in Hebrew, but it's a real problem in English. Either one is correct, I believe, because again, there's ambiguity in how to translate that.
Great. Well, thank you, Don, for that question here today. And no doubt, you've got many, many more questions, folks. And certainly, answersingenesis.org is a great go-to site. And typing in your questions there, Dr. Faulkner, as you put together your book here, the Heavens, a Different View, what would you like the takeaway to be from the reader?
I want people to have a greater appreciation of our Creator. When people look at these pictures, I don't want them to say, well, those are cool pictures. Wow, isn't the space nice? Isn't astronomy a cool science? Those are all true. But as Psalm 19 tells us, the heavens do declare God's glory, and I want people to see the Creator behind all of that.
Indeed, indeed. And friends, you will come away with that very feeling and thought as you go through the book entitled The Heavens, A Different View. Again, it's available through our VCY bookstore this month at 40% off, just being introduced here. And would like to mention that if you'd like to obtain a copy, you can go to vcy.com, or I should say multiple copies, because it's a great book to give away as well, vcy.com, or by calling 1-888-722-4829. Certainly was fascinated with seeing things I've never seen before, and thanks for helping us to see that this all came from our wonderful Creator God, Dr. Faulkner.
Thank you for having me.
Indeed. Again, folks, the website is vcy.com, where you can obtain the copy of the book, or 1-888-722-4829. And I'd just like to close off with the verse I began with from Jeremiah 32:17. Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. Remember, the God who put everything into place, created this universe, is a God who cares for you, and nothing is too hard for him. God bless you, folks. Thanks for joining us today on Crosstalk.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Take Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.